This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 9th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, after a decade of protests, the FCC finally approves rules to cap prison phone rates. Outrage grows in Florida following the death of a teenager tased by police. And it's been 77 days since President Obama pledged to begin releasing Guantanamo prisoners who the U.S. has cleared for release. We'll speak to a lawyer for some of the more than 50 men who have now passed the six-month mark of a hunger strike. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Texas-based encrypted email service provider Lavabit abruptly closed down Thursday afternoon. In a carefully worded statement, the company's owner and operator, Ladar Levinson, wrote that the decision was between shutting down Lavabit or becoming, quote, complicit in crimes against the American people. Levinson added that despite the constitutional right to free speech and making two separate requests, he has been legally prevented from sharing the experiences which led to the drastic decision. The wording of the statement suggests Levinson is under a gag order, which can accompany national security letters or sealed court orders. Hours after Lavabit made its announcement, Silent Circle chose to shut down its encrypted email service, stating the company could not guarantee the privacy of data sent over email. In its statement, Silent Circle said it has not received subpoenas, warrants, or security letters, but chose to act in a preemptive manner. Silent Circle will continue to offer its real-time voice and encrypted instant messaging services, which use different protocols than email. The American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, is holding its 40th anniversary meeting in Chicago, drawing scores of protesters opposed to legislation the lobbying powerhouse has promoted. Teresa Campagna has more from Chicago.
Teachers, parents, students, nurses, carpenters, and union workers gathered in front of Chicago's Palmer House Hilton this week to protest a prominent meeting between lawmakers and corporate lobbyists. ALEC has been called, quote, a corporate bill mill because of the model legislation it churns out and lobbies for on the state level. According to the Center for Media and Democracy, more than 640 ALEC-backed bills have been introduced in 2013 in all 50 states and the District of Columbia. One piece of ALEC-backed legislation has come under recent scrutiny, Florida's Stand Your Ground law. ALEC has also put its weight behind legislation that attempted to block paid sick leave in New York and revoked collective bargaining rights for unionized workers in Michigan. While protests largely remained peaceful, several violent arrests were made over the three-day span. Teresa Campagna, FSRN, Chicago.
Several events took place at the United Nations today to mark International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples. Among them, a walk to the land at the end of a 140-mile river journey to remember the first treaty between Native people and white settlers in the U.S. Melinda Tuhus reports from New York City.
Hundreds of supporters were on hand to greet the dozens of Native and non-Native paddlers who had journeyed for almost 2 weeks to raise awareness of Indian treaty rights. The Two Wampum Treaty was signed in 1613 between Dutch settlers and the Iroquois Confederacy. That accord served as the basis of more than 500 other treaties in the U.S. signed with Native peoples, all of which have been violated or broken. Sub-Chief Vincent Mann of the Ramapo Lenape Nation near New York City was at Pier 96 when dozens of paddlers came into view on the Hudson River.
I don't know if I can describe this feeling. The feeling of seeing our people come around the corner like that is an absolutely amazing thing.
A group of riders on horseback from the Dakota Nation also rode to the UN for the Indigenous Day commemoration. Today's event also served as a forum for modern-day issues involving indigenous land in the U.S. and included concerns about natural gas fracking, the protection of water resources, and recognition of territorial sovereignty rights. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, New York City.
thousands of people from around the world have flocked to the Mexican state of Chiapas to mark the 10-year anniversary of the autonomous governance system set up in territory held by the Zapatista National Liberation Army, or EZLN. Tim Russo reports.
The largely Mayan-led rebel organizations, Five Caracoles, or Cultural Centers of Resistance, began receiving hordes of Mexican and international supporters earlier this week in anticipation of the launch of the Zapatistas' latest initiative, the Escuelita, or Little School. The Escuelita, which will start giving classes next week, will provide an inside look at the construction of the EZLN's participatory governance system from a Maya indigenous organizational perspective. 10 years after the inauguration of the original so-called Good Government Councils, the civilian base of the Zapatistas today celebrate a functioning autonomous government in over 30 municipalities with a total population in the tens of thousands. The autonomous communities administer their own schools, clinics, potable water systems, and collective projects with no intervention or financial support from either federal or state governments. Tim Russo, FSRN, Chiapas, Mexico.
And those are some of today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. For more than a decade, incarcerated people and their families have petitioned the Federal Communication Commission to regulate the soaring cost of prison phone rates, which can be as high as a dollar a minute. They say the exclusive contracts states make with telecommunications companies put too heavy a burden on low-income families that can't afford to visit a loved one in person. Today, following a 2-to-1 vote to lower and cap the phone rates, the chair of the FCC declared their wait is finally over. In Washington, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Holding back tears, Maryland resident Bethany Frazier urged the three sitting commissioners of the FCC to approve a rule that would set national caps on the cost of interstate phone calls to prisons. Frazier described her struggle to raise her 5- and 10-year-old sons while their father served a prison sentence, saying her monthly phone bills exceeded what she paid for food and electricity combined.
Losing their father to prison also meant losing an income while gaining a painfully large phone bill. I would do anything and pay any amount to keep my children connected to their father. But choosing between essential needs and keeping kids connected to their parents is a choice no family should have to make.
The FCC approved the rule in a 2-to-1 vote Friday morning.
The ayes have it so ordered.
The commission will now set a cap of 21 cents per minute for debit and prepaid calls and 25 cents per minute for collect calls. This will create the most drastic reductions in states like Ohio, Alaska, and Alabama, where calls can cost up to a dollar a minute, not including fees. The new rule will force telecom companies to prove the rates they charge states for prison calls are based on the actual cost of providing a secure phone service. The rule also bans companies from charging more to accommodate hearing or speech-impaired prisoners who may need video conferencing services.
This order fulfills our obligation to ensure just, reasonable, and fair phone rates for all Americans, including the millions with loved ones in prison.
That's FCC Acting Chair Minion Clyburn, who became choked up several times while speaking about the importance of the rule, citing studies that show a lack of communication with family members is a major factor in a person's chances of recidivism. One of the formerly incarcerated plaintiffs in the FCC petition, Jackie Lucas, told FSRN right after the vote that he knew personally both the importance of phone contact and the heavy burden on families.
I knew I was going to come home, and I wanted to make sure that everything was right when I got there. Make sure that I talked to my daughters. I had kids. I had grandkids. And then, you know, it was something that really kept me going. If I had a call with her, you know, maybe once or twice a week, it really made it so good that I could talk to her. It was such a help just to have that phone call. When it came down to coming back into society, talking on the phone was what I needed.
With his family in Washington, D.C., Lucas was sent to serve his sentence first in Youngstown, Ohio, then Florence, Arizona, then Sussex, Virginia.
My mother spent like $500 a month just to talk to me in different places that they sent me all over the country. And it was so much of a strain for her. She didn't have things she's supposed to have, but she still sacrificed that. Made sure that she talked to me. Matter of fact, she gave up her house. She was staying in an apartment, and she couldn't afford it, so she moved to my sister's house because of the phone bill, too.
Both Clyburn and the other commissioners noted several times that the rule is long overdue and described the decade-long campaign of lawsuits, petitions, and protests in the streets that made Friday's vote possible. With the help of attorney Lee Petro, a group of families with loved ones in prison began petitioning for this rule back in 2001.
Over the intervening 12 years, the original petitioners, led by Martha Wright, whose grandson was incarcerated in four different prisons across the country, sought relief from the FCC for excessive phone rates and ancillary fees charged by the telephone service providers. These rates often exceed $17 for a 15-minute phone call, and the additional fees for funding accounts, using wireless numbers, and obtaining a refund can push the cost of one call to more than $25.
With the new rule in place, a 15-minute phone call will cost about $3.75. The changes will affect the lucrative prison contracts of for-profit telecom companies like Global Tellink. And because they fought this rule at the agency level, they may decide now to challenge it in court. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
This week, Guantanamo prisoners passed 6 months on hunger strike. According to the military today, 54 men are still on the strike. 39 are being force-fed through nasal tubes. In a statement to FSRN, Navy Captain Robert Duran called the practice, quote, medically sound and designed to preserve the life and health of the detainees. The UN has described force-feeding as torture, and the American Medical Association says it's against its medical ethics. A group of prisoners also renewed their legal challenge to the force-feeding at a federal appeals court in Washington, D.C. this week. Today marks 77 days since President Obama renewed a pledge to begin transferring the 86 prisoners who have been cleared for release by the U.S. government. For more, we're joined by Attorney David Reams. He represents more than a dozen Guantanamo detainees. Welcome back to FSRN.
Glad to be back. Thank you.
What's the latest you're hearing from your clients about the conditions at Guantanamo as the hunger strike passes the six-month mark?
Well, the hunger strike appears to be on the wane. By how much, we don't know, because the military plays with numbers. In terms of conditions, they're still subject to humiliating genital searches if they want to meet with their lawyers or speak with their lawyers. Those who remain on hunger strike are kept in isolation cells and deprived of such basic necessities as toothpaste and toothbrushes. Even those who have been moved to communal areas are subject to very stringent restrictions. Conditions are somewhat better for detainees who are not hunger striking than for those who remain hunger striking.
Last we spoke, and that was in April, one of your clients, Yassin Ismail, was being force-fed. He had lost 50 pounds at that point. What is his status now?
Well, he is being force-fed. As far as I know, he's still being force-fed. The irony is that when you're being force-fed, you do have more energy and you are more alert than when you're not. That's the whole purpose of the force-feeding. But the bottom line is that the military hasn't come closer to meeting their ultimate demands than it was before, and is still determined to break the strike by any means possible.
This week, a group of detainees filed an appeal with a federal court of appeals in Washington, D.C. against the force feeding. There have been legal challenges. Previously, a judge, Judge Gladys Kessler, ruled that the practice is painful, humiliating, and degrading, but that the court lacked jurisdiction to halt it. She said President Obama had that power. What about actions in the courts specifically on force feeding?
In general, Congress has removed the courts from the field when it comes to Guantanamo. There are provisions of federal law that say that the courts have no business interfering in conditions of confinement or other matters that fall outside of the realm of habeas corpus, that is the basic right to seek your freedom. And Judge Kessler considered the force feeding issue to be beyond the jurisdiction of the courts because of the congressional legislation.
Captain Robert Duran, a prison spokesperson, said this week that the decline in hunger strikers is due to their objectives being met. He said, quote, "They've heard the president speak. They've heard their attorneys talk. They've seen the naming of the new ambassador to start the diplomatic process. We think they feel they have achieved their aims." David Reams, your response to the military.
I do think that some men have stopped hunger striking for just that reason. But there are also a number of other factors that could be at play. The decline in the military's count coincided with the start of Ramadan. It'll be interesting to see whether there's an uptick after Ramadan is over and Eid is over, but I must say that Captain Durand has put his finger on an important point, which is that from one standpoint, the detainees have accomplished their goals.
In May, after a lot of attention from the hunger strike, President Obama did pledge once more in a speech to take action to address issues at Guantanamo. Earlier this month, he met with Yemeni President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi to discuss transferring detainees. The Obama administration also announced that two Guantanamo detainees would be transferred to Algeria. David Reams, you represent 14 Yemeni detainees. How would you rate his follow-through on this pledge?
Well, President Obama is very good at creating the illusion of movement even when he's standing still. It remains to be seen what effect the appointment of this envoy at the State Department will have, given that he's subject to the same legislative and policy restraints that his predecessor was subject to. In addition, with respect to the Yemenis, I believe they're going to be the last to go, even the approved ones. The meeting with President Hadi, I believe, was really meant for Yemen's own domestic politics and Hadi's strength there. There is still the whole long process of periodic review boards for detainees who have not been previously approved for transfer. In this whole jumble that I'm describing, I'm skeptical that anything has fundamentally changed, and I mean, I'll believe it when I see it.
David Reams is an attorney for more than a dozen Guantanamo detainees. He joined us to discuss the U.S.-run military prison where more than 50 prisoners are still on hunger strike. That hunger strike began more than 6 months ago. David Reams, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
In Denver, local residents, officials, and voting advocacy groups had a chance to weigh in on election reforms at the latest hearing set up by a presidential commission. The meetings follow last November's election when people's right to vote was hampered by lines that stretched for hours, voting machine errors, and election officials who were improperly trained. Some witnesses highlighted Colorado as an example of strong election reform, while others urged the commission to do more to make voting easier for people with disabilities and to increase ballot access for independent candidates. FSRN's Jim Poland reports.
The Commission on Election Administration's task is to make a formal recommendation to the president on best practices in election administration. Obama chose his former White House counsel, Robert Bauer, and libertarian political scientist Benjamin Ginsburg to co-chair the committee. The commission has identified issues it will address, including number and quality of polling places, poll worker training, access for uniformed and overseas citizens, voting machine technology, and provisional and absentee ballots. The commissioners said that they aren't focusing on federal legislative changes. Co-chair Ginsburg said that the council's emphasis is finding solutions, not identifying risks to fair and accessible elections.
I think we're looking at the fact that every issue that has been raised to us is an issue in some localities, but the vast majority of jurisdictions actually handle them quite well. So our goal is to find the ones that work and try and inform the ones where there are problems of what they could do to improve.
Participants from Colorado lauded a new state law intended to make voting and registration more convenient and accessible. Colorado voters can now register and vote on Election Day and vote at any polling center in the state. All voters will also be sent mail-in ballots. Elena Nunez, the executive director of Colorado Common Cause, helped craft the new law.
There is a lot to learn from Colorado, and I think other states could really draw on the Colorado experience. Rather than making it more difficult to vote the way some states have, Colorado has taken great strides to increase participation and access to the vote.
Some hearing participants, including invited officials and members of the public, said funding for elections isn't keeping up with rapid technological changes.
What the federal government can do is help push along the federal voting system certification process.
Matt Crane, the clerk and recorder for Arapahoe County, Colorado's third most populous, said that although his 2006-era voting systems are okay for now, other jurisdictions need help.
There hasn't been anything certified in quite some time. And so if they can get that process going again to provide options to jurisdictions that have an immediate need for that, that would definitely help.
Voting rights advocates also want to see a great priority on accessibility. According to a study from Rutgers University, voter turnout for people with disabilities is nearly 6% lower than people without disabilities, affecting about 3 million potential voters. Additionally, in the 2012 election, more than 30% of voters with disabilities reported difficulties at the polls. Faith Gross is the Voting Rights Program Coordinator at the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People, headquartered in Denver.
None of the machines that are available for use in Colorado at polling places are fully accessible for voters with all different types of disabilities, and not all of them really afford privacy and independence as they were supposed to do.
Independent voters testified that they are being excluded from the democratic process. The advocacy group independentvoting.org delivered a letter to the commission at the Denver hearing signed by 1,000 independents from all 50 states. The letter called on the commission to broaden its mandate to ensure that independents gain representation on the Federal Elections Commission and Board of Elections. Gwen Ballard from Carbondale, Colorado, was one of several independents who gave testimony.
Primaries, the fact that we are shut out of the primaries, that's my most important issue.
Some have criticized the narrow mandate of the commission, which excludes voter ID laws. Voting rights advocates nationwide say they'll continue to raise awareness about how these laws, passed by dozens of state legislatures, disenfranchise voters. Many are also closely watching states like Texas, Florida, and North Carolina following the U.S. Supreme Court's June ruling on the Voting Rights Act. This week marks the 48th anniversary of the historic legislation. The Presidential Election Commission hearing in Denver was the second of four and the only hearing scheduled west of the Mississippi. The first was held in Florida in June. The others will take place in Pennsylvania and Ohio next month. The commission must deliver its report in December, 6 months after the first public hearing. Jim Pullen, FSRN, Denver.
Anger is growing in Florida after police used a taser on an 18-year-old who died shortly after. Police chased Israel Hernandez after they saw him spray painting on an abandoned storefront, one that witnesses say already was marked with graffiti. Also known as Rifa and an immigrant from Colombia, Hernandez was well known in the community for his artwork and skateboarding talents. His friends remembered him in this video produced by WeAreChange.org.
Somewhat of a mentor to me. Like, he gave me a place to put my talent.
He was a really good friend. He was a beautiful person. And when I found out that this happened, I couldn't believe it, and I didn't know how to take it.
He was a cool cat. He was awesome, man. He'd make jokes. He was always, like, inspired by everything. He wouldn't harm a fly. He wouldn't hurt anyone.
One of his friends who was with Hernandez as the police pursued him described what happened.
I hear the officers on the radio, we got the Hispanic male in custody, and then I go to the scene where they had him by the bank, and he was just there, like, laying motionless, and there's cops around him clapping, like, congratulating and laughing.
Miami police say they're looking into the death and put the officer responsible, Jorge Mercado, on paid leave, according to the Miami Herald, which also reported the officer has had 6 complaints in the past 13 years, including excessive force and battery. At a press conference Thursday, Hernandez's family called for an independent investigation. The family's lawyer, Jose Javier Rodriguez.
We don't know exactly what happened. We don't know if protocols were followed. There's a lot of unanswered questions.
Friends and community members organized a vigil last night at 71st and Collins, the last place Hernandez painted. Many say they're shocked at the excessive use of force for an incident that the city labels as a misdemeanor. They want to keep pressure on leaders to thoroughly investigate the killing and raise awareness about police brutality. According to Amnesty International, 500 people have died in the U.S. after being tasered since 2001, 65 in Florida alone. Supporters of Lynn Stewart rallied in New York Thursday as a district judge heard arguments to allow the imprisoned attorney to return home under compassionate release. The 73-year-old, who is being held at a federal facility in Fort Worth, Texas, has stage 4 breast cancer. Her family says her health has deteriorated since being put in prison and she cannot get adequate health care. Stewart was sentenced to 10 years in prison in 2010 after being convicted of providing material support to terrorists, amongst other charges. Prosecutors said Stewart violated what's known as special administrative measures by conveying messages from her client, Omar Abdelrahman, to followers in Egypt. Supporters, including the imprisoned Mumia Abu-Jamal, have vowed to keep the pressure up. From a Pennsylvania prison, Abu-Jamal has this commentary.
Join Ralph's fight for his wife's life. Ralph Poynter, the husband of lawyer and now federal prisoner Lynn Stewart, is on a mission to save the life of his wife. His wife, Lynn, was an almost legendary lawyer who brought her whole heart and all of her legal training to the defense of the downpressed, the poor, and many of their most militant defenders of many movements of the 70s, 80s, and beyond. Recently convicted of violating some post-9/11 special administrative measures called SAMs in defense of her client, the blind sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, she was given 28 months, and after appeal, it was up to 10 years. Here's the problem. Lynn is 73 years old with advanced breast cancer. Such a sentence is a death sentence. Ralph, quite understandably, is doing whatever he can to bring his wife home, where around family and loved ones, treatment can be more efficacious. Ralph is protesting in the Capitol, in Washington, D.C. these days, to try to effect her compassionate release. They've won statements of support from the former Archbishop and human rights activist Desmond Tutu, and civil rights activist and former comedian and presidential candidate Dick Gregory. Indeed, Gregory started a liquid fast in mid-April in protest of Stewart's continued caging. Join Ralph, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, and Dick Gregory in bringing Lynn home alive. For more information, contact lynnstewart.org. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Headlines editor was Shannon Young. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can find sights and sounds from FSRN's Global Reporters. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/FSRN. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.